As an added benefit to reoccurring donors, we are sending out DCO face masks to any monthly contributors for 3 months or more at the $5 plus level. Please send your size preference, either large or youth or small size, along with membership email and mailing address to info@dcontario.org. And you can check out what they look like in the show notes. This podcast was specifically created for Distress and Crisis Ontario organizations and their volunteer responders to provide training and educational assistance on a variety of topics. As information evolves and changes, these podcasts are meant to offer ongoing support with the goal of updating them on an ongoing basis. We thank the volunteer responders and the contributors to this podcast. Please visit our website, dcontario.org, for more information and how to access free mental health services. Thank you.
This is Caitlin Plant for Distress and Crisis Ontario, and this week we will be interviewing Laura McGregor on caregivers, caregiver stress, and specifically how to do self-care as a caregiver when you possibly have very, very little time for yourself. So Laura, thank you for being here today. Would you mind starting off by telling us a little bit about your personal journey as a caregiver for your son, Matthew?
Of course. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here. I was the caregiver for 21 years. Well, it's a complicated answer. I was a mother of three boys who are all 2 years apart. One of my children, my middle son, lived with significant intellectual and physical disabilities, as well as considerable complex medical issues. And I cared for him for 21 years until his death. So my caregiving journey is tied up largely around my son, though I want to honor the fact that mothers take care of children all the time. Mm-hmm. Often, usually.
Fair enough. So what sort of support system did you have in place to supplement your caregiving duties?
Yeah, you know, that varied over the course of 21 years of Matthew's life. So I would say in the first several years of his life, virtually none. Mm-hmm. So from maybe 0 to 5 or 6, from about 5 to 10 or 11, we had some supports. We had some in-home supports, both from nursing and PSW, home care agencies. We also used a respite service for families caring for medically fragile children, but I was still providing probably the bulk of care. So for the first decade, I provided either all of the direct care or most of the direct care. We moved to a much more supportive model that was family driven, so not service driven. Simply because we realized that if we didn't make some changes, I couldn't sustain the level of care. And the risk of having to admit Matthew to some sort of long-term care facility would become very real. So we funded care for Matthew in the home out of our own pocket. And I want to note how privileged we were to be able to do that, and many families cannot. But what that did mean is that for the second decade of Matthew's life, I had a significant amount of support for his 24-hour care. I, however, was still the coordinator. I was the one who managed the caregiving team. I made decisions around hiring and firing. I navigated all of the health professional appointments. I was the one who did all the frontline advocacy work, and I filled in, I provided direct care as well and would fill in all sort of the direct care gaps when a service provider couldn't work or was ill or had to take a sustained period of time off. So, and I'm hoping you can edit that out. for this last decade of Matthew's life, I was supported, and I would identify as more of a team member with a lead role.
Okay. So you've touched on there a little bit that it was a process to find the support system that worked for you. So how difficult was it to land on that, that system that finally worked?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a complicated question. It was not easy. You know, first of all, there's the more existential struggle of coming to terms with the fact that I couldn't be the one to provide all the care, which is challenging as a mother, because you feel you should be providing all the care. And there's this sense of failure if you're not the one providing all the care. Though I rationally knew the level of care my son required was unsustainable for one person. And then there was the journey of navigating the public support system, which is extremely complicated. And that's an important thing to know when you're providing support to caregivers, that many of us, especially if we're caring for children, it's different if it's spousal or elder care, but we're navigating services that are organized by the Ministry of Health, by the Ministry of Community and Social Services, as well as the educational sector, usually. None of those agencies or those ministries provide enough support. It's most caregivers would say it's inadequate. It's also fragmented, and it requires a lot of advocacy sometimes to get the services you need. So there's that part of then figuring out what's available, advocating for the services you need, and then realizing they're still not enough. And then coming to terms with the fact that we were going to have to augment those services if we were going to be able to keep my son at home, which was our priority. And again, knowing that many families don't have the level of resources that my husband and I were simply fortunate to have is an important part of, I think, providing supports that many families are coping with inadequate supports, and we did as well for the first decade.
Okay, so in the middle of all of that complicatedness and trying to care for your son and do all of this advocacy work that I'm sure took up lots of your spare time, how important was the ability to care for yourself so that you could continue to care for your son?
Yeah, of course, it was a priority, and we all know it's a priority. And if you talk to any caregiver, or I would use the word extreme caregiver, which describes a particular type of caregiver in the research, and extreme caregivers are usually family caregivers who are providing extraordinarily complex and continuous 24-hour care for someone with whom they have an emotional attachment. So unlike paid or professional caregiving, there's this emotional piece as well. So guilt associated with not being able to provide all the care. There's this whole emotional piece that gets involved. You know, I think we all know that self-care is a priority. We all hear the cliches about, well, if you can't take care of yourself, you can't take care of someone else. And we all understand they're true. It doesn't mean that for people who are providing extreme levels of care, that you have the opportunity to provide that care or to take time for self-care, to care for yourself. And I think many of us live these very complicated lives where we know we're supposed to be doing this, but we simply aren't able to. And that becomes, self-care becomes one more thing on the checklist, the to-do list that you just don't get around to doing. And in my life, self-care for sustained periods of time was something as simple as, do I have time to take a shower? Do I have time to eat a meal while it's still hot? Do I have time to actually sleep for more than a few hours? I had huge stretches of my life where I never slept through the night. And that was just a fact of life.
Yeah. And I think that specifically, that always having that underlying tiredness and the inability to sleep through the night is just going to snowball and impact all of the other little things, because then things that would normally be challenging on their own become that much more because they're also trying to do it with a lack of sleep, and it just continues to make things more difficult. So you've kind of answered my next question already in all of the answers already given. But I guess what did you do to make sure that you did get those times to yourself as often as you could, knowing that it wasn't nearly enough?
Yeah. You know, and I think one of the things that needs to be put on the table is there are times when you don't and you can't. And many caregivers live with that reality, that even something as simple as personal self-care is impossible. The luxuries of things like yoga or going for a walk or chatting with a friend or watching a movie, these are luxuries. But in terms of being able, when I was able to care for myself, for me, it really hinged a lot on sharing Matthew's care with other people. So developing a team of caregivers that I could work with, that I could trust with my son's care, developing positive relationships and developing a sense of being able to work together. That was really important. And so taking advantage of whatever resources were available and then really trying to tailor them to our particular home environment. We also made a conscious effort to take advantage of out-of-home respite opportunities. And that's hard. It's really hard to relinquish your care, the care of your child or a beloved family member, to people who aren't yourself. Especially I found it difficult to access out-of-home respite or to make the decision to do that. We used it quite liberally throughout Matthew's life. For me, what really drove the decision to do that was the knowledge that I wouldn't have sustained periods of time to be really present to my other two children or to the other important relationships in my life, like my marriage, mm-hmm. without those sustained periods of time where Matthew, so weekends or a week here and there, where Matthew was in an out-of-home respite program. So taking advantage of all of those resources available and then identifying and developing creative strategies. There's a lot of literature that talks about the fact, and it is echoed by my own lived experience, that because resources are often inadequate for caregivers who are involved in these very sustained and complex caregiving responsibilities, that self-tailored, creative, thinking out of the box solutions are the way to go. Mm-hmm. So we developed all sorts of creative strategies over the years. We had a large basement bedroom, and at one point, a Conestoga College nursing student moved in with us, and we offered her free room and board in exchange for X number of hours of Matthew support. And it was wonderful. She was great. She got some wonderful work experience working with a complex care child. So she jokes that she learned about feeding tubes with us, not mm-hmm. at Conestoga College,
yeah.
Developed her competency and comfort with feeding tubes in our home. And she became a beloved member of our family. We went to her wedding. We spend mm-hmm. time now with her children. And this was a creative thinking out of the box strategy that worked well for everyone. She had a great reference when she graduated because I could call a nursing agency and offer this great reference for pediatric nursing skills. Mm-hmm. It cost us in that we offered her free room and board. But it was a very cost-effective way for us to get creative care for Matthew that worked well for everyone. So developing these creative out-of-the-box strategies that might work for your particular family mm-hmm. for us carried us a long way.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think you mentioned in there as well that it's so important to know that you can trust who is providing care when you are not able to, because I feel like, yeah, the entire ability to be able to take some time for yourself mentally, you're not going to recover at all if the entire time you're worried about what's happening while you're not in the room. So I think that's a very important piece to focus on a little bit as well. So was there any one form of self-care that you would find yourself practicing more often than others, or just a certain activity that anytime you had a chance to do that thing, it always left you feeling more refreshed?
Right. So I'm just going to piggyback a little bit on a comment you made about the emotional distance, because I think that's an important one. For me, I learned that I was most able to sort of give myself that the emotional, intellectual respite, that turning that part of my brain off when Matthew was in out-of-home respite. Mm-hmm. Even when he was in the home and he was in the care of someone else, I always had part of me that felt turned on and responsible. So that mm-hmm. may be an important piece to know. In terms of my own self-care, what sort of worked well for me? For me, being able to physically get some distance from Matthew, as I mentioned, was an important part of my own ability to engage in self-care. So once I was able to do some of the basic stuff, you know, things like get some sleep, we started using overnight in-home care. So we would have a nurse in our home through the night, or a PSW. PSWs were a little bit different in that they had to wake me if certain things happened, but that was okay because I could sleep knowing someone would wake me. Nurses were able to do a bit more intervention. So once I was able to do some of those things, I was sleeping through the night and I was able to, attend to more of my own very basic self-care, having space to sort of get away and get out. So I started doing long distance hiking. And that for me was actually my most wonderful form of respite and self-care. It gave me time to really sort of turn that part of me off while also just enjoying being outside and engaging in exercise and fresh air. That was a huge part of my own self-care. I think for me, another huge part of my self-care was actually returning to school and engaging in research and study of caregiving. It ended up opening up this whole new avenue professionally for me. But for me, that was how I was making sense of what I was living through. Other people are going to make sense of it in different ways, through conversation, through counseling, through peer support groups. And I've done all of those things over time. But for me, a huge part of my own self-care was finding ways to make sense of what I was living, which happened to be an academic journey for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. I think when we were talking about this interview before, in your notes, you had mentioned that the hiking became a really useful thing for you as well, because it was something that you could measure your achievement in, which when I read that, I went, oh, that makes so much sense, because so much of your life was kind of unstable with the care that you were providing, that this being able to see exactly the distance that you went and saying, I finished that, was such a release for you. I'm bringing that up because that when I read that, I went, oh yeah, that makes so much sense.
Thank you for reminding me of that. You're right. Caregiving, we forget. Like, caregiving is it's heavy work. It's hard work. It's done behind closed doors. You're often dealing with taboo functions you can't talk about, like toileting and dressing and personal care. And it's never ending. You do a task, you provide the care, which you do because you love this person, but it's never done. There's never this sense of, I have finished, look at what I've accomplished. Because an hour later, you need to do another task. Yeah. That for me, I ended up hiking the entire Bruce Trail, which is approximately 900 kilometers from Niagara to Tobermory. And being able to look at something and say, I've accomplished this, and have this sense of completion was a huge part. As it turns out, I also met a hiking community. So I made friends out of the disability world, which, well, my support system within the disability world and caregiving world was a huge part of my coping. Having friends that also were outside of that world and could remind me there was another world where we talked about different things ended up being very healthy for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for reminding me of that.
Yeah, no. So I guess from here, my next question is whether or not you have any advice for those caregivers who are struggling to take that time for themselves right now.
Yeah, and that's a really hard one because, sitting here and saying you need to do this, which is true, is hard because it becomes one more obligation caregivers are often struggling with. And we need to remember that we're often speaking to women. Statistically speaking, caregivers are almost always women, though in the case of elder care and spousal care, we do see things like husbands stepping in or sons. But when we're talking parental care, it's almost always mothers. And there's this whole narrative around women of selfless caregivers, that we are intuitively designed to be caregivers. This comes naturally. And I want to honor the fact that as a result, women have this implicit and explicit expectation of often providing care to the point of self-sacrifice. Mm-hmm. So sitting here and saying, oh, gee, this is one more obligation you have, can be just overwhelming. Mm-hmm. That said, it's so important. And so wherever I would encourage, I think one of the things that I would encourage is that women in particular need to be reminded that it is okay, perhaps even necessary, to be selfish, to place your needs of care as a priority. And that is very difficult to do because the messages from society, from family members, from the medical establishment are so, and church structures for people who are involved in faith-related structures, mm-hmm. are so powerful and they are so explicit. So simply giving yourself permission to place yourself in that place of being a priority, and then taking advantage of whatever respite opportunities you can either access or create are vital. And finding time even in those small ways becomes so important. And knowing that there's often no easy answers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome. So as we wrap this interview up, is there anything that you'd like to add that we've not talked about yet?
I think the one thing that you triggered when you sent the prep questions was the things not to say to a caregiver. Mm-hmm. And maybe just to add those. For those people who may be trying to support caregivers, often the cliched responses of, you know, life won't give you more than you can handle. God won't give you more than you can handle, for people who are working within faith structures. These are often not very helpful. They often do more to make the person saying that feel better, feeling like they're offering something in a situation where there are no easy answers, no fix-it solutions. And what they do is they often just shut the story down, and that because there's now this pressure that I've got, this expectation that I've got it, I'm not able to talk about the fact that maybe I don't feel like I don't have it, that I'm overwhelmed. I don't feel that I can do all of the things that I'm being asked to do. So that's sometimes not a helpful answer. What is a helpful answer or response is giving people space to talk about what they may be living in a non-judgmental, sort of non-anxious way, simply being present. And often caregivers don't have safe spaces to talk about the chaos they're living, or even the feelings of resentment towards someone they love and feel very obligated towards providing care. It's a very complicated existential space to be in, this idea of love and sort of resentment. It's very paradoxical. And sort of creating space where caregivers can maybe talk about that, sometimes it's the only safe space they might have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I think having a non-judgmental area where you can say, hey, I love this person that I'm caring for, but this is so hard. And knowing that you can be heard. Yeah, and I understand that would be a huge thing. Yeah.
Right. And to honor that, those feelings, simply because I know I often didn't feel I had permission to say those things in any other environment, or that if you did, they were so loaded with guilt and shame.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being willing to do this interview with me. I really appreciate it.
I'm happy to share the story, and I'm grateful that you're taking the time to talk about these things. They're often not talked about.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Hi, I'm Damien, one of the editors of the DCO Learning Forums podcast. We are committed to providing the most current and up-to-date information. With your help, we can make it better. Please consider going to tips.pinecast.com/jar/distress-and-crisis-ontario.com or by clicking the link in the show notes. And by donating, monthly contributors will be able to access a special podcast feed. In it, we'll have additional content and some more in-depth pieces on some of our most popular topics. Thank you.